This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Welcome to True Crime Garage. Wherever you are, whatever you are doing, thanks for listening. I'm your host, Nick, and while you're at work doing 9 to 5, this guy's in the garage cold kicking it live. He is the captain.
And it's enough to drive me crazy if I let it. It's good to be seen, and it's good to see you. Thanks for listening. Thanks for telling a friend. Thanks for telling your mother.
Tonight we are drinking Bobber Lager by the brilliant minds over at Logboat Brewing Company in beautiful Columbia, Missouri. Garage grade, let's go 4 1/4 bottle caps out of 5. Bobber is an unfiltered lager brewed with inspiration from pale German lagers, and the noble hops provide a little bitterness, and my favorite part, Bobber has a crisp, clean finish. And this cup of inspiration was brought to us by these fine people. First up, we have
Princess Jenny from the FB. And the L.I.
I'm not sure what the F.B. is, but L.I. has got to be Long Island. So there you go. Next up, a big, big thank you to Candace and Joel in Little Rock, Arkansas. Candace and Joel say, rock your jib.
Well, they're kind of getting aggressive with the jib.
Next, we have Shannon up in beautiful Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Like your jib.
We got Peter in Hixton, Wisconsin. Remember, we said according to the USA Today, Wisconsin has several of the drunkest cities in the US of A. So, of course, they get my love and respect. So, a tip of the cap to you, my friend, Peter in Hixton.
Well, we're coming after you, Wisconsin. Parts unknown. Raise your glasses. Unite.
Speaking of parts unknown, we have Dolores.
Maybe Dolores, you can start drinking a little more. Pull your weight around here.
Next, we have Jill, who's got the cupcake blues in Omaha. And last but not least, we have Julie, who says, cheers from Columbus. Wait for it, Captain. Wait for it. It's Columbus, Georgia, our sister city.
Get out of here with that nonsense.
I-O. We want to thank everybody who purchased our bonus show, The Bricka Family Murders. If you haven't checked that out, you can do that by going to the iTunes store or our store page at truecrimegarage.com.
And if you'd like to follow us on social media, Snapchat, Instagram, Untappd, all that stuff, you can find us with the handle at True Crime Garage.
That's enough of the business. Everybody gather around, grab a chair, grab a beer. Let's talk some true crime.
They told me that I was being arrested for a homicide.
And what went through your mind at that point?
I mean, I knew I had never hurt anyone, so I wasn't really too worried about it.
I believe you testified on direct. You thought Chuck was an odd man.
Yes.
You think that's funny?
I think he's an odd man, yes.
You think that's funny?
It's not funny.
Okay. I just thought you were smiling. I thought you thought it was funny.
No, it's not a funny okay. laugh.
Well, I mean, this is America. If you want to laugh, you can.
No, it's not a laugh. I never thought I'd be arrested for a crime I didn't commit. Would you? Would you believe you'd be arrested for a crime you didn't commit?
I didn't commit one.
Neither did I.
All right. Part two of the Ryan Ferguson case.
Yeah, well, there you go, Captain. You get to hear a few snippets and little pieces of the trial itself. Mm-hmm. I tell you what, I found parts of this trial to be incredibly fascinating. Right there in that clip, you are hearing the prosecutor, this is Kevin Crane, with some back and forth while Ryan Ferguson is on the stand.
Mm-hmm.
And that's Kevin's kind of loud, booming voice that he has that's perfect for a courtroom setting, kind of really trying to get under the skin of Ryan Ferguson, kind of picking on him a bit there. And I'll tell you what, the best way I could describe Kevin Crane, the prosecutor.
He's arrogant.
Yeah, but you know, the thing about him that I found strange was that he almost appears to be like an actor portraying a prosecutor in a movie or a TV show. Like the way he speaks, the when he chooses to raise his mm-hmm. voice and the way he kind of gestures at things and struts around the courtroom. You're right. He's very arrogant, but I get the it's like I'm looking at an actor playing a role, not a real life person.
Yeah, he's a douchebag playing an asshole.
So what ends up happening here is that we have the police and the prosecution. They end up offering Chuck Erickson a plea deal in exchange for his testimony against Ferguson at Ryan's trial. Mm-hmm. The trial doesn't take place until 2005. Now, along with Chuck Erickson's testimony, we also have Jerry Trump. Remember, he's the janitor working at the Tribune that night.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he states and he testifies at trial that he saw Chuck Erickson and Ryan Ferguson at the scene. He says that those are the two men that he said jumped up from behind Kent's vehicle when he called out into the parking lot that night. Now, how does Jerry Trump arrive at this situation? Because he wasn't able to identify them early on in the investigation, right?
Right, and like you stated, you know, detective said, this guy's not a credible eyewitness.
Yes. And so the thing here is what Jerry Trump says is that while he was in jail on unrelated charges, his wife had sent him a news article about the crime. And he claims that on that newspaper, he saw photos of Chuck Erickson as well as Ryan Ferguson and immediately recognized them as being the two men that he had saw standing by the vehicle that evening. Now, so on the witness stand, we have this other weird situation where we have Chuck Erickson, who was unable to give a detailed description of the crime or the murder during the confession, quote unquote, confession portion
right.
of the questioning and interrogating. However, once he gets on the stand, we see a very different Chuck Erickson. We see a guy that he's able to give an extremely detailed description of the events of that night as well.
Well studied.
Yeah. As well as extremely detailed description of Ryan Ferguson strangling Kent Heitholt.
Chuck, he might've been a drug user, but he has a high level intelligence. So he also would argue like these intellectual battles with the lawyers.
Mm-hmm. One thing I found strange, though, when they show Chuck Erickson walking, being escorted in to the courtroom, mm-hmm. did you see that part where it looks like he almost turns and kind of stares down Ryan Ferguson? Like he tries to stare him down. Like he goes out of his way to move his head all the way to his left to right. kind of just.
And later know. On, there'd be claims by Chucky saying, hey, a lot of the reason to get him to talk about or not to confess but to testify against Ryan was because all these people were saying, all these rumors around him were saying Ryan was going to throw him under the bus.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to throw you under the bus first. So maybe that's why he was staring him down like, hey, I gotcha.
Right. Now the defense, they countered that all of the evidence found at the crime scene that night, it pointed elsewhere. It did not point to Ryan Ferguson. None of the hair, none of the blood, or the fingerprints collected at this crime scene that night, they did not match Ryan Ferguson or Chuck Erickson mm-hmm. as a fact. And
there's seven fingerprints, right, mm-hmm. on the car.
Mm-hmm.
Seven fingerprints on Kent's car. And none of them matched. They didn't match Erickson. They didn't match Ferguson.
Right. and there were no traces of the victim's blood found in the vehicle, in Ryan Ferguson's vehicle that he was driving that night of the murder.
Yeah, so it basically comes down to that there's zero evidence against Ryan, and there's two witnesses that weren't credible to begin with that are now somewhat credible, I guess, and they testify. And Ryan actually gets on the stand, which is pretty unheard of in a murder trial, and he's convicted. And he's sentenced to, what, 30 years?
I believe 40 years total. He gets convicted of second-degree murder and robbery. Now, the thing here is, though,
Again, no evidence of robbery.
Right. And having watched portions of the trial, I will admit here, Captain, that seeing Chuck Erickson on the stand, if that is, and I imagine his testimony took a long time because they have him acting things out. They're going over question over and over again. The thing here is seeing him on the stand, you look like you're watching a man that seems 100% certain in everything that he is telling you. And not only that, he's 100% certain that he himself is guilty.
Right.
And this is why he's come forward and he's telling on this Ryan Ferguson character. So I can see how the jury was swayed in that way, even despite the lack of evidence. But you would think there would be some physical evidence.
Well, I think the thing that's hard for us to understand is when you watch a trial, we go, how could they find him guilty? Well, remember, this jury didn't know him. They didn't see the little Dateline montage of him growing up and how great of a kid he was and how amazing his calf muscles were, right? They don't see that. So all they're seeing is a guy that they don't know, and maybe he doesn't. I don't think, to me, as far as like Ryan Ferguson on the stand, he comes off as somebody that is malicious enough to do what Chucky is saying. But Chucky seems a little odd. And when he's making these actions and showing how, well, this is how he punched him, and then this is how Ryan strangled him, he looks a little crazy.
Yeah.
So, you know, as far as the jury's concerned, why wouldn't they believe that this guy is possible? You know, this guy possibly had something to do with the murders because he's a little nutcase, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, ultimately, we get, like we said, Ryan gets 40 years in prison. We have Chuck Erickson who gets 25 years was part of his plea agreement with the prosecutor. The problem here is, Captain, there are some real problems with this story. And I'm talking about the story that the police and the prosecutor put together and supplied to the jury to ultimately get this conviction.
Mm-hmm.
So let's go through some problems with the story, okay?
Okay.
So first off, now, This is according to freeryanferguson.com.
It might be a little biased.
I could see if some people would think it's a little biased, but this statement would be verified later, and we'll get into that later, okay? But the first thing that we have here is that the bar itself, remember By George's? That's the captain's favorite bar.
By George, my favorite bar.
According to employees of the bar, as well as a city ordinance and state statute, that bar closed at 1:30 a.m. on that Wednesday becoming Thursday morning.
Right.
Okay, so
that goes with Ryan's story.
That goes exactly with Ryan's story. He says, we were at the bar till 1:30. I drove Chuck home, and then I went to my house. Now, keep in mind, that goes completely against Chucky's story. Now you got me saying Chucky. It goes against Chuck's story. Because
that's Chucky.
It goes against it in two manners, right? First off, they weren't at the bar as late as Chuck had originally stated.
Mm-hmm.
And second of all, they would not be able to come back to the bar at 2:45 a.m. and then stay for an additional hour to an hour and a half dancing and drinking and having a good time because, according to the state law, that bar was not open at that time.
At least proving that one of the statements in his story is a lie.
Mm-hmm. The next thing that we have to point out is Ryan's phone records. We touched upon this in the first episode.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now, so going through this, Ryan Ferguson, he was absolutely on his phone. His phone was being used between 1:41 a.m. and 2:09 a.m. This does not entirely discredit Chuck's statements, right? because Chuck does state that after they left the bar, Ryan was on his phone.
Right, but it does confirm, it reconfirms Ryan's statements.
You're exactly right. It goes more toward the way of Ryan's statements having been true, that he went home, he was on his phone, then he went to bed. Okay, so now we have Dallas Mallory. Remember, mm-hmm. we talked about Dallas Mallory. He was the
player.
Slightly older guy, you know, a little bit older than the guys, Ryan and Chuck. And he was the one that they saw at the intersection that night shortly after the murder. So Dallas Mallory is the only person who can corroborate any part of Chuck's story.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in December of 2004, okay, that was what they got from an affidavit in December of 2004. He later then stated that he was not at that intersection that night. He had not seen either Ryan or Chuck that night. Furthermore, we have proof that Dallas Mallory did not have a valid driver's license
at the time
or a vehicle. He didn't own a vehicle. He had had an OMVI or DUI, whatever they call it in Missouri.
Right.
And he had lost his license due to that. And I believe he sold his car either because he couldn't use it or to pay for some of his legal fees.
Right.
So he doesn't have access to a vehicle. He doesn't have a driver's license at that time. Now, furthermore. The thing that happens here is, well, remember, Chuck was able to state that Dallas was wearing a police officer's uniform that night for a Halloween party.
Yeah.
Well, the problem with that is police say, well, there's your proof that Dallas Mallory saw those guys at that intersection. The problem with that is later the Ferguson family is able to prove that Dallas Mallory and Chuck Erickson were at one of the same Halloween parties earlier that night. That Chuck could be confused and he actually saw him at a Halloween party. I believe there's a photo of the two of them. We have Dallas Mallory standing behind Chuck Erickson, and Mallory is in full police uniform outfit.
Right. So, yeah, Chucky blacks out, does a bunch of blow and a bunch of other drugs, and he blacks out. But he does remember seeing this guy at some point, Dallas, and he saw him at some point in a police outfit. So that goes with his story, but also proves that it could have happened at a different time. The other thing that's interesting is the fact that, you know, he claims that Dallas stopped at a red light. Well, those lights aren't red or green at that time of day. They're flashing red or flashing yellow.
No, so they're flashing yellow. So they're not a cycling light.
Right, but what I'm saying is if at an intersection, you'll have one section that's flashing yellow, and the other intersection normally flashes red.
Mm-hmm.
So one will have to proceed with caution. The other one might have to stop depending on the traffic. The way that Dallas was going, quote unquote, is he would have been faced with a yellow light. So he never would have had to stop.
Yeah, I believe.
So again, these are multiple sources saying that this story is bullshit.
We also have Shauna Orne, and we talked about her working at the Tribune that night. Now, she is called to testify, but she never specifically is asked, did you see Chuck Erickson and Ryan Ferguson there that night in the parking lot? And what
she told the cops and what she told prosecution is that those were not the two guys that she saw that night.
Yeah, and she would later state, that's why Kevin Crane did not specifically ask me that question, because he knew I was going to say no. Those weren't the two guys that I saw.
Right, but doesn't the defense get to, like, you know, have interviews with these witnesses and talk to them? And so they would know that if I ask her on the stand, can you point to the person that you saw that night in the courtroom, that she would say, and I can't because they're not here.
Right.
And that would have been huge for the defense.
It would have been a big step in the right direction for the defense.
And they talked a lot about how, like, he would slow draw everything. Took forever.
Well, and it did. And you know what I think a big part of that was, though, Captain?
Lack of preparation is what it was.
I think it's partly that, but I also think it's a bit of a surprise. I think that you had Erickson on the stand and you had Trump on the stand that were saying much different things, much more detailed things, pointing every arrow at your client. And I think it took him by surprise. I think it took the attorney by surprise.
You get a lot of this information know what I mean? You're handed a lot of this information.
We also see a situation where they were not handed some information that could have helped their defense as well. So I don't know that I want to go out there and say you're handed this information.
Ooh, no, but what I'm saying is that you have a list of these people and you can have a somewhat of an idea of what they're going to say. And you're listening. You get to cross-examine afterwards. So you know what I mean? So you do have time to prepare as it's happening. It's not like you're the first one asking questions is what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then we also have the possibility of a potential other suspect. Now, remember we talked about, we went through the detailed accounts of that night before, we talked about a man named Michael Boyd. Well, he's not really investigated. He's interviewed, but not what I would consider investigated.
Well, he should have been investigated because he was the last person to talk with Kent. So
yeah, as far as we know, that he's admitting that he was either the last or second to last person to talk to Kent Heitholt that evening.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go by his timeline compared to when the 911 call is placed, that almost puts him standing next to or right by Kent at the time of his murder or very close to it.
Well, yeah. And look, there's a ton of evidence and ton of speculation that's like they got the wrong man. But the fact of the matter is he's convicted and he's in jail and he's sentenced to 40 years.
Now, Ryan Ferguson will eventually get to appeal this conviction and they will have another trial. Some new things come to light at this trial, right? But unfortunately, we have a situation where the verdict, the guilty verdict, is not overturned with this first appeal.
Yeah, even though they brought up, you know, tons of evidence, mm-hmm. tons of evidence that shows that the detectives in the defense didn't interview, I think, 11 witnesses.
That should have been called in the first trial?
Right.
Yeah, and then in 2009, we have a new character comes into the fold, right? We have high-profile Chicago attorney Kathleen Zellner. She decides to take on Ryan's case pro bono. And in 2012, well, her hard work and her investigator's hard work, it pays off because at this point, both Chuck Erickson and Jerry Trump, basically the two that together mm-hmm. took down Ryan Ferguson and got that guilty verdict, even though there was no physical evidence, they got them to recant their trial testimony in statements given to both Zellner and her investigator.
Now, yeah, and just to show you how powerful this is, that if you do recant, especially because you were in a trial, mm-hmm. you can be facing perjury charges, and so you could actually do time in prison for this.
Right.
So as far as the outsider's eyes, to me, this recanting your statement actually holds a bunch of weight to me,
because
mm-hmm. you're possibly facing, you know, jail time.
Well, Zellner, she files and she gets a habeas corpus hearing. So during this hearing, this is when both Chuck Erickson and Jerry Trump admitted that they lied in Ryan Ferguson's trial. Now, Chuck Erickson claimed that the prosecutor, this is Kevin Crane, that he had pressured him into implicating Ryan. Chuck testified in the habeas hearing that he does not remember the evening of the murder because of his heavy drug and alcohol use that night, and that he did, in fact, black out. Now, we also have the situation where you see Chuck, he comes forward and he originally says that Ryan had nothing to do with this, that Chuck was the one that single-handedly carried out this murder.
Right.
But in this hearing, he states that he has no memory of that evening, just like he told the police in his original statement. Now we have Jerry Trump, okay, who recants as well. His story about his wife sending him the newspaper and him seeing the pictures of the two boys in there. He actually says that it wasn't his wife that sent him the newspaper. That he actually didn't see that newspaper until he was at Crane's office. And Crane had showed him the photos from the newspaper. And basically,
right, which is basically stating that the prosecutor is helping me create the story to be an eyewitness. And that's illegal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And like we said, Crane was in some of his own legal troubles at the time. probably thought that, you know, I don't want to pick a fight with the prosecutor, with this very aggressive prosecutor. And, you know, stating that Crane told him something like it would be helpful to the state. It would be helpful for Jerry Trump if he could identify the two guys at the crime scene.
Well, and then Michael Boyd's going to come back into the story as well. This is the co-worker that claims that he talked to Kent right, you know, seconds before he's murdered. And his story has changed like five times.
Yeah, Zellner, Ferguson's attorney, will point out, you know, to the trial that we have these conflicting stories that have changed time and time again, as well as she's going to point out that timeline that we talked about earlier, that because of some of Boyd's own words, that places him with Kent Heitholt at the time, these are her words, at the time of his murder.
Well, weren't they also able to present evidence that proved that there was evidence withheld from the defense?
Correct. Mm-hmm. Yes, this would have been some of those eyewitnesses that you stated that were called in this hearing. One of them being Kim Bennett. Mm-hmm. She was a person that was at the bar that night, at By George's that night. The prosecution did not tell the defense about speaking with Kim Bennett. Now, why did they not tell them? Because Kim Bennett told the prosecutor that she was at the bar that night and she left sometime between 1:15 and 1:30 a.m. And during that time that she left, she saw Ryan Ferguson and Chuck Erickson get into Ryan's vehicle and drive off at that same time.
Right, which would go with Ryan Ferguson's story.
Yeah, the other person that they failed to tell the defense about was a guy by the name of Mike Shook. Well, who is he? Well, he's very important to this case, in my opinion, because he is an employee at the By George's bar. Mm-hmm. And he testifies at this hearing that the bar, in fact, did close at 1:30 a.m. and that he did not let anybody back into the bar after the bar had closed. This, again, would disprove Chuck Erickson's story.
Well, yeah, let's call it what it is. You know, Chucky and the police's story.
Mm-hmm. So now, Captain, we also have Shauna Orndt, and we talked about her quite a bit, so I won't go through the whole thing. But during this hearing, we do get to hear her state why she thinks that she wasn't asked to directly identify Ryan Ferguson, because we know that answer. But furthermore, she states that her interaction with the prosecutor, Kevin Crane, she found him to be what she called threatening, that he constantly was asking her to implicate Ryan Ferguson as being one of the people that she had seen in the parking lot the night of the murder. And she time and time again would not. And he became very aggressive and almost threatening to her.
Right. And like she stated from the beginning, telling the police officers, telling the prosecution, that's not the guys I saw that night. Not the guys I saw.
Mm-hmm.
And then you got this prosecutor, you know, the one that's a douchebag playing an asshole, being aggressive and basically threatening, hey, you need to say that this was Ryan and she wouldn't do it. It's weird to me that he would even put her on the stand. But
Well,
but who knows?
Luckily for Ryan, that this conviction is eventually vacated. This would be in late 2013. He was soon after released from prison and exonerated of all charges.
Yeah, and this was a lengthy, you know, we kind of skipped over it. But if we went through every single trial and every single appeal, there was a bunch of failed attempts, and probably a lot of that had to do with the fact that the prosecutor became a judge.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one of his big cases, and that would go against the whole system, saying the whole system's bad, that the cops are bad, the prosecutor's bad, and now the prosecutor's a judge, so therefore the system is failed.
Yeah, so, and I'll tell you what, and I know that the conviction is overturned, but we're not going to finish there, because what I want to do next, Captain, after this beer break, let's go through this, because what happens here is we have a conviction overturned. Now this presents a whole bunch of other questions. You know, what really did happen that night? So let's answer those questions after this quick beer break. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. We all carry around different stressors, big and small. When we keep them bottled up, it can start to affect us negatively. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and to figure out how to work through whatever's weighing you down.
If you're thinking of starting therapy, I highly recommend that you give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/garage today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/garage. This show is proudly sponsored by BetterHelp. Check out BetterHelp.com/garage today.
The best part of spring cleaning takeaway is the post-clean clarity you get. It's kind of like when you find out that you've been paying a fortune for wireless. When Mint Mobile has phone plans for $15 a month when you purchase a three-month plan. It's time to switch to Mint Mobile. All plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. Use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan and bring your phone number along with all of your existing contacts. Ditch overpriced wireless. With Mint Mobile's limited time deal and get 3 months of premium wireless service for $15 a month. Save a lot of money with Mint Mobile. Get their great mobile wireless service delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. That's premium service at a great price. To get this new customer offer and your new 3 month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/TCG. That's mintmobile.com/TCG. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/TCG. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3 month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun. And that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
Everyone loves a good family mystery, especially one with as many twists and turns as June's Journey, a hidden object mystery game with a captivating detective story. It takes you back to the glamour of the 1920s, with a diverse cast of characters. You'll step into the role of June Parker and search for hidden clues to uncover the mystery of her sister's murder. Use your observation skills to quickly uncover key pieces of information that lead to chapters of mystery, danger, and romance. And customize your very own luxurious estate island. Think expansive gardens and beautiful buildings. Collect scraps of information to fill your photo album and learn more about each character. And you can chat and play with or against other players by joining a detective club. Can you crack the case? Download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android. June needs your help, detective. Download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android.
All right, we're back. Cheers, everybody. Cheers, mates.
Cheers. So here's how we're going to do the second half of this thing. Now, yesterday when I was hanging out in the garage with the captain, I told him, you know, I'm going to bring with me tomorrow some questions that I kind of just want the two of us to talk through together. Want to hear his opinion, give my opinion, and kind of walk us through this case a bit and maybe come up with some answers here. Because with Ryan Ferguson being let go, exonerated, now, to me, there's all kinds of questions in this case. But to be fair, I should point out that the captain has not been told in advance about these questions. So I'll start you off with question number one, Captain. Do you think that Ryan Ferguson actually committed this crime or was involved in this crime, but somehow got lucky and ends up getting off?
I don't believe so. I think he is a kid of good character. Not a kid anymore, obviously, and there's no physical evidence. And so, I mean, he was convicted on basically two lies.
Mm-hmm.
That's my thoughts on it.
Well, I agree with you. The only time I kind of questioned his guilt was like what I said with Erickson's demeanor on the stand. I questioned it a little bit, but having seen the actual confession tapes and the interrogation tapes, that kind of discredits that 100%. But also seeing the composite drawing that was provided by Shauna, it actually looked somewhat like a mashing. If you took Chuck's face and you took Ryan's face and kind of smushed them together, that it would look somewhat like the both of them. However, she outwardly states that these are not the guys that I saw that night, and there's no question in her mind. So to me, I got to go with what she's saying.
Well, when they also say, I think the first thing for me that I went, oh, that's a little odd, is when they claim that one of the people they saw had an athletic build.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of 17-year-olds are not going to have this noticeably athletic build. And Ryan did. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of the first thing that made me go, And I see your point that Chucky was very convincing on the stand. And that's probably why he was found guilty, was based off of Chucky.
Mm-hmm.
But let's just go with the whole fact that, you know, he was coached up by Crane. He was coached up by the prosecution. He was coached up from the beginning. When he went to come in and confess, he was coached up at the word go of the confession. Yep. So, yeah, of course, he's an expert on what he has had conversations about, but these weren't things that actually happened.
Question number two. Okay. You know, Ryan Ferguson, in our opinion, didn't do it. He's been exonerated, I think rightfully so. But do you think that Charles or Chuck Erickson did have some involvement, or, like he did say at one time, committed the crime completely by himself? If we go by Ryan Ferguson's timeline, which we believe to be true, that they left the bar at 1:30 a.m., he was able to return Chuck to his home and continue on to his own home and get there by 1:40, then it's conceivable that Chuck could have returned to the parking lot of the Daily Tribune in time to commit the murder.
Yeah, but again, with his confession, and yeah, it's 2 years later, and Chucky has a drug problem, he might still have one in jail, who knows. But again, lack of evidence, physical evidence, there's never any talk about DNA, but you would think that you'd have at least some kind of DNA on the belt. And again, they're not bringing it up, so let's just assume it's not there. 7 fingerprints on the car, not one of them match Chucky, not one of them match Ryan. So is it possible that he got dropped off by Ryan and he was in this coked out state, in this alcoholic state, and he just went out looking for more? It's possible, but again, where's the evidence?
Yeah, and he doesn't even, you know, I said that somewhat the facial thing could look like the composite drawing, but he doesn't physically, you know, his height and his weight and his build do not match what is described by Shauna there. The person that she describes is several inches taller than him, several pounds heavier than him, maybe 20, 30 pounds heavier than him.
And his motive doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. Plus, his what he claims he was wearing that night does not match the description of the clothing that Shauna gives at all that evening as well. The thing here, too, regarding Chuck, like I pointed out in the, I don't recall if it was earlier this episode or if it was late yesterday's episode, but the whole process about the interrogation.
You might want to not drink so much.
The whole process of the interrogation where the detective wrongfully says that Kent was hit 15 times with this object, and he gets Chuck to agree to 15 being the number.
Right.
It's obvious to me, not only does Chuck not know how many times Kent was hit with this object, neither does the detective. So I think that that clears up Chuck for me.
Again, weird with no skull fracture.
Mm-hmm.
That's an odd thing to me.
And when they're at trial and Chuck is describing how he hit Kent and how forcefully and how fast he says that he hit him and in that overhand motion.
Right.
I struggle to believe that if they were using a tire iron or some kind of tire changing tool that they got from Ryan's trunk that he brought on his own, that hitting with that velocity that he would not be able to, that there would be no skull fracture. Seems right. Very strange to me.
Yeah.
This is kind of an out of the box question for you, Captain. All right. But do you think that there is something wrong with Chuck or Charles?
Yes. And I don't know, chicken or the egg. I don't know if it was something was wrong with him mentally, so he was then self-medicating through drugs and alcohol. And then that led him to the point where he's at now. Because he definitely seems a lot clearer these days.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so which one was it, the chicken, the egg? Or what, you know, did he start using drugs and that created some mental problems for him? I think he's not all there.
Yeah, I get the vibe that there's some kind of personality or social, some kind of disorder there. Maybe it's undiagnosed. We do know that the prison system does not do a great job of checking on people's mental health
right.
in situations like that.
And just being confined to that space is going to do a number on your mental health anyways.
And I understand that I'm observing his life on small sample sizes, you know, over the course of a period of time, over the course of 10 years or so, right? But what I saw is I'm seeing almost a different person every time.
Right.
Did you get that vibe? Like,
okay. Yeah, but let's be honest. I mean, crime would happen when he was 17.
Mm-hmm.
He would confess when he was 19. So that's when we'd first start seeing him. It's 19, 21 is first trial of Ryan Ferguson. So that would be the first time we'd see him. And then you're seeing him later, you know, the other trials, you know, 3 years after that, 5 years after
right.
that. So, I mean, you're going from a 19-year-old, you know, to a 20-some-year-old. That's a whole different world.
No, and I agree. And that's why I pointed it out that I'm talking about him over the course of a period of time.
Right.
Because I agree that physically and mentally and emotionally, he's changing and adapting throughout the course of time. However, to me, I felt like I was seeing whoever he decided to be or whoever he was told to be in that moment.
Yeah.
And meaning when he is interrogated or when he's, especially when he's being driven around and questioned about the locations of things and where they went, he looks like the confused person that he believed he was.
Right.
He looked like a blank canvas that knew nothing, that had nothing on it, and was going to wait for people to apply their own impressions. When I see him at the trial, that you got to admit, that's a 180 degree change right there. It's not just a guy that
the
goes,
first trial. Yeah.
Yeah. Not just a guy that goes from knowing nothing to knowing everything. There's like a certain amount of hate in his eyes. And it almost looks to me like there's hate in his eyes for Ryan Ferguson. You know, like I said, it appeared mm-hmm. to me like he kind of tried to stare him down as he walked into the courtroom. And as he was sitting there on the stands, you see somebody that's very aggressive. He can't wait for the prosecutor to get the words out of the prosecutor's mouth to start answering his questions.
Well, again, but if that speculation is true and what he was saying is they have inmates talking to him, and I wouldn't put it past the cops going, hey, let's tell some of these inmates that Ryan's going to turn on him. And we're going to get Chucky all nervous,
mm-hmm.
right? So, maybe it was like, you know, I kind of got us into this mess, and I don't really know what happened that day, but you want to throw me under the bus? Look, Chucky is not an idiot. He actually seems like he's actually a pretty bright guy. He likes to challenge. He likes to debate. Probably would have made a pretty good lawyer. But at the end of the day, he's a little nutso. So that little nutso turned into, I got to get this guy before he gets me.
But while he's on stand, he seems like a man of conviction. You know what I mean? Of a man that said, you know, I've done something wrong. and this is the only way I can make it right. And I'm going to go down fighting if I have to, but I'm going to make this right.
Yeah, Chucky is so weird to me because one, you have this ridiculous story that doesn't make any sense, and you don't even have any of the details. And then you come forward, they hand you the details. Now this guy's in jail. You're in jail. A couple years later, you feel so bad because you don't know if Ryan was there. So you put the whole blame on yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And then that kind of helps out Ryan. But at the end of the day, neither one of you probably were there. And Ryan Ferguson's story is probably true.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I feel for the guy because, like I said, there is something off there. Definitely has some intelligence. But something is definitely wrong there.
I agree, and I'm glad that you saw it too, because I was thinking maybe I'm kind of weird and just seeing something that's not there. But
well,
you're weird. But I saw it again when he changed his story to that Chuck was the only one guilty, and then later when he changes his story back to I don't remember anything of that night. I swear when I look at him and he says that the final time, I see in his eyes and I almost see his face. Of that 19-year-old boy again, of that blank canvas that just truly didn't know what was going on and is waiting to be told what actually happened that night. We should point out though, right, that Charles Erickson remains imprisoned.
Yeah, which is it's a crime, man. It's a crime as much. Look, Ryan Ferguson is definitely the all-American boy. You know, he's a good-looking guy. He's physically fit.
Apparently, right. His calves are incredible.
Incredible calves. I think he does like some fitness stuff now, like Spartan races and stuff like that. Smart kid. Seemed to always do the right thing. Was involved in athletics and stuff like that. And yes, Eric got them into this mess.
Mm-hmm.
But he's like the forgotten one. Oh, great. We got Ryan out. Okay, that's great. But we still have somebody convicted of this murder. And we all know. And the system knows. That Chucky didn't do this, right? So that's a crime in itself. And then you got to put on top of that, there's a victim in all this, right?
Right.
There's a guy that we don't know what the motive of his murder was.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a vicious murder. I mean, this guy was held down, probably had a foot on his chest, and somebody's choking the life out of him with his own belt.
Mm-hmm.
And Kent deserves better than that. And yes, I'm glad that the justice system, made a wrong a right. And yeah, I'm sorry that Ryan had to spend time in jail. That's injustice. I believe so. But it's injustice that Chucky's behind bars. It's an injustice that we're not investigating the case to solve the murder of Kent.
Yeah. And we should point out, too, that Ryan has said that he wants to help Chuck, or who's going by Charles now, he wants to help Charles with his release from prison as well, even though, like you said, you know, Ryan ends up in prison because of Charles.
Yeah.
And, you know, he said that Ryan will continue to fight for the innocent people that are in prison, including Charles Erickson.
One of the things that you can tell that makes Ryan such a good dude is one, Trump, which lies, right? Lies
Jerry
on the
Trump.
Jerry Trump lies on the let's not make this political.
Let's not start a fight.
Oh man.
You don't want that fight.
you don't want to fight the man with small hands. What I'm saying though is he forgives Jerry Trump. Jerry Trump has had his trials. He's not a good guy. Anybody that has crimes against children, I can't have their back. But what Ryan says is he can forgive Jerry for lying.
Right.
He also forgives Chucky. So I think that's a sign of a pretty self-intuned person. Now, I don't think he forgives Crane at all. But that's my opinion. But so I think it's good. Ryan, anybody, if you're invested in this case at all, do as much as you can to help Chucky out, because he's just going to be there.
Well, and Crane is sort of the puppet master, right? And it's really tough to forgive the puppet master. You can forgive the puppets, but you don't forgive the puppet master.
Yeah, but in Crane's defense, you are handed a case based off of the detectives.
Mm-hmm.
There is no case. Now, he should have, from the word go, say, I'm looking at these tapes and this doesn't line up. No, thank you. I'm not running with this case. The cops should have stopped this from 2 years. They had nothing. That's fine. But but you didn't get anything afterwards. You got a bunch of false stuff. And when they should just be lined up, taped against the wall, and I, just let me punch their face for a while. Because they kept on saying stuff like, well, I'm not interested in that. I'm just interested in the truth. No, you're not. You stupid piece of shit. You're not interested in the truth. What I was saying is it should have stopped at the detectives. It should have stopped there. And when none of the pieces of the puzzle were fitting, you stop. And they deserve punched in the face.
All right, let's shift gears here for a second, okay? So, Captain, without naming names or pointing fingers or doing a whodunit type thing, do you think that this was a premeditated murder, or do you think this is, you know, unplanned?
I don't know either way. I don't look, because obviously it was a vicious attack, and I don't think that a vicious attack needs to be planned or not. Mm-hmm. And also, I think the evidence of maybe it's not planned is who would get in an argument or a tussle with a guy and plan on, choking him to death with the guy's own belt.
Yeah.
I mean, that'd be kind of a weird plan to come up with.
You bring up a very good point there. And to further that point, it's, that you're attacking a large man with an object that we've pointed out time and time again was not strong enough to create a skull fracture, or with not enough force to create some kind of fracture. That seems, like you said, a bad plan. It doesn't seem to be a well thought out plan to bring that kind of weapon there. And then, obviously, you can't plan on using somebody's belt to strangle them. Especially a man of his size. How are you going to get that belt off of him?
Well, it's very odd to me that the police came up with the motive of robbery when there's not really much signs of robbery.
The way that I understand it is they only came up with the motive of robbery after the fact, after having spoken to Charles Erickson about the crime and why he would have done the crime.
Right. But instead of trying to make the pieces of the puzzle fit, they're creating their own pieces.
Yeah. And so when they're in the first investigation part of the investigation, early in the investigation, they don't really have a motive to work off of, other than looking for those two quote unquote college age Caucasian males.
Right. So what would be some motives? I mean, maybe he's having an affair with somebody. Maybe it is just random. But like I said, there's no sign of robbery. And so you're just going to, so the motive is just, I was walking down the street and saw this guy and decided I want to choke him to death with his own belt. Maybe he had a gambling problem. To me, the choking the guy to death with his own belt seems very violent,
vicious.
Very vicious, yeah. Almost like you're trying, like that was a statement piece. Mm. And so he was a sports writer. Was he into gambling? I'm not for sure.
Well, okay. So you brought up motive. The problem with motive for me kind of cycles back into, is this premeditated or unplanned? Here's what I think. Here's what I see anyway. I see somebody, like you said, this strangling, the way that it went down is very vicious. So that, to me, either points to somebody that had a very deep hatred for this man and wanted to kill him. That would imply that it's premeditated. Or that this was some kind of rage, that there was some kind of argument or some kind of incident that took place, and it was, split-second rage that took this person over. And
yeah, they raged so hard they didn't cause a fracture, though.
Right. And so, I've asked myself, how would this person come in possession of a belt that was on the man that they attack? I've heard Bill Ferguson, he pointed out something that was interesting. He said that his daughter came up with a theory. And remember, we pointed out the size of Kent Heitholt. He was a large man. He was not only tall, but he was big.
Mm-hmm. Burly.
And the thing is, his daughter said to him, sometimes with larger people, they will, especially men, they will undo their belt in certain situations when they're getting ready to sit down. We know that Kent was potentially leaving for the evening. He could be driving home. Maybe he found it uncomfortable to drive with his belt on, and that was something that he typically did. and that would make the belt easy for the person that committed the crime to take it off. So that's an interesting thought there. My thought too, though, would be, is there a chance that Kent was looking for a weapon and undid his belt in an attempt to use it as some kind of weapon? We know that whoever he was, you know, arguing with, whoever he's having an incident with, or whoever decided to attack him already has a weapon. Mm-hmm. Maybe he feels, if I can get a weapon, I can better defend myself, and removes his own belt or attempts to remove his own.
Yeah, or like you said, I mean, he's just unbuckling his belt to get in his car. He gets attacked and then just pulls it out. But I don't know. The other thing too is, like you said, we're not going to name any names, but we might as well.
Well, we're going to have to.
Well, Michael Boyd, right?
We have to name Michael Boyd.
But
yes.
Here's something that people should take a clue on. I think when Ryan was losing all his appeals, they needed to find the person, right?
Yeah.
They didn't have enough. They couldn't check enough boxes to get him acquitted on his own, that they needed to check the box of, oh, by the way, here's the guy that did it. And I think they went after him, and the media went after him. And yeah, he changed some of his stories. I don't know if he's innocent. I don't know if he's guilty. But here's what I do know, is anything that once Ryan was released, anything when they're talking about this case, they don't mention Michael Boyd. And I think they do so for probably legal reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you don't have a bunch of evidence, then you can't be naming this guy as this prime suspect if he's not.
Well, and as we said, Michael Boyd was interviewed, but not, quote unquote, investigated. And, you know, people that don't know much about this case are going to go, well, why was he not investigated? He was one of the last people to speak with the victim.
Mm-hmm.
Well, my only guess is this, is that, you know, they were told to be looking for two Caucasian guys. Michael Boyd is African American. Therefore,
and there's only one of him.
Yes, and there's only one of him. So he doesn't become their immediate suspect. That's probably why he was not investigated early on. Now, I do want to throw this out there too at you, Captain. And I'm not going to comment on the competence of the police department or the detectives involved in this case, because I don't have a full understanding of their investigation into the murder of Kent Eichholt. I only have an understanding of the portions that involve Ryan Ferguson and Charles Erickson.
Right.
Okay. So during that, we have 2 years before we get to those guys. Now, one thing here is we have a parking lot. We have several employees inside the building. You know, when you first look at this case, if you don't know anything about it, you kind of assume that maybe there's this one dude working all by himself, and he walks out into a dark parking lot in the middle of the night and happens to get randomly attacked. It's not so much that. We have a building that's got several people in it, in a parking lot that has portions that are well lit, and we have two very obvious security cameras on the building.
Right.
So what that would make one think is, well, those security cameras were not working. This guy's killed in a parking lot where anybody inside the building could potentially see the attack, first off. Anybody manning those cameras or watching those videos could potentially see or have evidence, video footage of who committed the murder.
Mm-hmm.
Who would know that those cameras were not working? Well, you would then assume it would be somebody working in that building.
Yeah, because they'd know that the cameras weren't working.
Yeah, and I hope... And I don't know that they did or did not. And that's why I won't comment on the competence on their competence regarding this investigation. But you have fingerprints. You have that hair. If those should be, and I hope that they were tested against employees that worked in that building.
Well, and also the belt, there's going to be DNA.
There should, you would expect to see some DNA.
There's at least touch DNA.
Mm-hmm. So I'm hoping that they tested that against the employees that were working that night and have somehow cleared them. It'd be nice to know that if they've done that. We've not heard.
But you're not going to hear anything about this because there's a guy that sits in jail that's accused of the murder. So this case is closed, my friend. They're not going to look into it.
And I'm afraid you might be right on that.
And also, look, it's, you know, Kent was a chubby white dude. You know, sports reporter. That's the injustice. There's so many injustices here. You know, like I said, Again, we can't speculate on the investigation, but they had nothing. So then you get a little bite and they ran with it, but they ran too hard, too fast, and they didn't do their due diligence, and they didn't view this as, we need justice, we need truth, like they said, you need truth. And then they handed off to a prosecutor trying to make a name for himself, and all the name you made, my friend, was shit stain. That's what you are, you're Judge Shit Stain now. And then you have two innocent kids that, you know, have basically been locked up since they're 19. And then on top of that, again, if Michael Boyd had nothing to do with it, you have media running his name through the mud and making him look like he's a piece of shit. And we have really no evidence of that, you know, because did they test his fingerprints? Did those match? Was there DNA? Nobody knows. So that's an injustice. And then at the end of the day, we got Kent that, you know, somebody's locked up for his crime. So nobody gives a shit. Mm-hmm. And that, I think when I first saw a documentary on this or a Dateline or something on this, I was really frustrated, but it was only a single, you know, a singular frustration that this innocent kid that could have been me or you or anybody that we grew up with charged with this vicious crime and then sitting in jail for almost 10 years when they're innocent, 10 years of their life being lost and how that affects their family. But now, I don't know how many years later after seeing that documentary, it's like my frustration has grown with that whole system. And there needs to be bigger checks and balances. Like I said, there needs to be, if a detective is going to interrogate, if the detective is going to make up falsities or give out details that they shouldn't give out, that, you know, makes the confession null and void, there needs to be better checks and balances.
Yeah, and I think that the defense team should have been able to do a better job of presenting the way that interrogation went down to the jury than what they did.
Yeah, but again, that's null and void if you don't even get to the trial.
Right.
You should have never got to the trial.
I agree 100%. As far as Michael Boyd's name goes, has it been dragged through the mud? Yes. It's not Kevin Crane's fault that his name has been dragged through the mud, in my opinion. It's been the attorneys for Ryan Ferguson that has brought his name up time and time again. It's the online community that's kept his name running. We've mentioned his name here, too, so we're just as guilty as anybody else. So, on that topic, do you think Michael Boyd, for you, it would be considered prime suspect, number one?
I mean, look, he's in the same location roughly about the time of the murder. So I think his story is very important. The problem is he's changed it multiple times.
Yeah.
So I don't think him necessarily changing it means that he's instantly guilty. But why are you changing the story, bud? You know, mm-hmm. Like, just tell the truth. Stick with the truth. Again, though, I feel for the guy because a lot of this stuff is them questioning him years and years later. So maybe by going through the events, you kind of remember things a little differently. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Like, obviously, he would remember that night more than most people. But what were his statements right afterwards?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So I don't know.
For me, I don't know that I would put him as my number one suspect. I don't have a number one suspect, to be honest with you. He would be somebody, a person that I would want to talk to.
Yeah, more. Of interest. And he might be able to lead you down the right rabbit hole.
And I think you have enough evidence that was collected at the scene to either clear him or maybe bring up charges on him. The thing that I can't get over, though, is there was a blood trail that led near the alley or all the way to the alley from the parking lot.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so a couple issues with that blood trail. One, could Michael Boyd have potentially left that blood trail? His car was parked somewhat in that area. It's possible. But the way that I've heard this blood trail described, I've never seen pictures of it, so I don't want anybody to go crazy on this,
mm-hmm.
But the way I've heard it described was that it was a mess of a blood trail, which would imply to me that it was created by more than one person. We do have Shauna Orndt saying she saw two people And we do know that they ran off in that area after right. they called for help. I am with you, Captain. I do find it very strange that somebody would attack somebody and then say, call for help. So what I'm getting at is you have two situations to me. I think it boils down to two situations. You either have a situation where these guys stumbled. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, unless it's one tacker and two guys were walking up and they came up to help. The guy mm-hmm. runs off.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden you're going, hey, call for help. And then you're like, shit, we got to get out of here.
Yeah. And you've gotten blood all over your shoes at this point and you've taken off.
Right. Maybe you have a prior, and you were just trying to look. It's different. If you've been behind bars before, you might go up to help somebody and the cops come and you go, hey, shit, I'm out of here. I'm not messing with those guys again.
Well, and if you see the way that they handled the Charles Erickson, Ryan Ferguson situation, that does not inspire you to come forward at any time soon and say, I was there and I stumbled upon this guy. He was attacked. I told them to call for help and then I left because I was drunk or because I didn't want to be in the area when this thing went down
right.
or I was afraid. I was afraid that whoever did this was still lurking in the parking lot.
Right.
The big problem I have is something that you asked earlier, motive. I struggle to find a motive for Michael Boyd to have done this, as well as I struggle to see any motive at all for this to have taken place. From everything I read about Kent, he seemed to be a great guy, well-liked at work, well-liked in the community. I know we don't know much about these people when we look into these crimes. We only get to see little snippets and little small sample sizes of their life. But I struggle to find any kind of motive here. This almost seems to me as some kind of random, crazy attack. And I think that is a big problem that has hindered this investigation, that mm-hmm. there is lack of motive. There is lack of reasoning and why anybody would commit this crime.
Yeah, again, I mean, being involved in sports, I'd want to know his background if he had any gambling problems there. So, I mean, to me, that would explain how vicious of an attack it was, and it would explain why they used his belt. He could have been taken off his belt, but again, to me, that's like, it's like making a statement.
Yeah, I really just get the feeling here. Like I said, no motive. I feel like he came across somebody or somebodies, mm-hmm. and there was some kind of altercation that broke out into a fight. I think he tried to defend himself in the person or persons. For lack of a better word, went crazy on him, went homicidal on him. And, mm-hmm. and this ended up being the result, unfortunately.
Well, overall, it's a sad case. It's sad for Ryan and his family. I think it's sad, again, for Chucky. And I hope Ryan does stick by his word and tries to help him as much as he can, because I think he has the loudest voice and the biggest platform of anybody on this case.
Mm-hmm.
And look, I'm all for good police officers, good detectives, good prosecutors. I want to believe in the system, but time and time again, you'll see these cases where the system fails all of us. It doesn't, it didn't just fail Ryan. It failed everybody involved. And then it essentially fails us.
And you're right. And while you're pointing out who this was sad for, it was sad for everyone, the Columbia community involved as well, including the Tribune as well, the employees there that worked with Kent. But as you were touching upon, Captain, it was a sad display for our justice system as well. It failed us that day. It failed so far as failed Kent, Ryan, and Charles Erickson as well. And I also do want to reiterate that, we have Ryan stating that Charles has his support, that he has Charles's back. He's going to continue to work to get some of these people out of prison that are innocent, including Charles. We also have the Ferguson family, who has offered a $10,000 reward for any tips that would lead to solving the murder of Kent Heitholt, which I think shows the compassion
and
as
the
well
character.
As character yeah. of the Ferguson family.
Yeah, and if you're interested in supporting Ryan at all for, him being in jail for 10 years, wrongfully convicted, check out Ryan Ferguson Fitness and you can .com, RyanFergusonFitness.com, and you can follow him on all social media. I know he's wrote some books and I think maybe he has another one coming out this year, maybe.
Speaking of books, how about some recommended reading here, Captain? This week we are recommending Queen City Gothic, Cincinnati's Most Infamous Murder Mysteries by J.T. Townsend. I've met Mr. Townsend once. Brilliant guy, great writer. We had a little Zodiac killer debate. But anyway, Queen City Gothic is fascinating. It's a fantastic book, and J.T. Townsend takes us on a sinister journey through 13 cases which took place in Cincinnati, Ohio between 1904 and 1971, including the Murder Zone Killer, The Bride in the Casket, and Terror in the Gaslight District. If you like Ohio criminal history or just cold cases in general, then you must have Queen City Gothic in your home library. And you can pick that up and add it to your library by going to truecrimegarage.com and click on the recommended page. We have our Amazon banner on there, which you can use to purchase any of the books or movies that we have listed. We will see you back here in the garage next week. Until then, be good, be kind, and don't litter.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.